A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on April 7, 2002, entitled, Two Understandings, When Friends Disagree. The texts for the sermon are Galatians 2, verses 11 through 14, and Luke 24, verses 28 through 43. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
It must be obvious to everyone that this world needs to learn to engage in conversation and dialogue, to be honest with each other, and to listen to each other in order that we might live in peace. Our world is breaking apart because we can't speak to each other or hear each other, listen to each other. I'm using this occasion, the week after Easter, to think about the resurrection from two perspectives, because in May we're having two scholars come our way who differ on their understanding of the resurrection. And they're coming in order to stimulate conversation among the faith community of Western Michigan, but to be a model for the manner in which such conversation can take place. Marcus Borg, who's been here a couple of times and is a real friend of this congregation, will be joined by N.T. Wright, who is an excellent scholar and who happens to be a very good friend of Marcus Borg. N.T. Wright is the canon of Westminster Abbey. If you watch the funeral on Tuesday of the Queen Mom, I've been wondering whether or not N.T. Wright may be a part of that, since he's the canon of that great cathedral in London. They were in school together at Oxford and became friends, respecting each other and holding each other in high esteem, and yet differing in their perspectives. And they become a good model for a way in which religious people can differ with one another and yet not break community, and converse with one another and seek to deepen the understanding one of another and to enhance that understanding. N.T. Wright is a rather traditional evangelical scholar. He's an excellent scholar, but his position is traditional and evangelical. It is what probably you grew up with, what I grew up with, the kind of position that I preached for many, many years. And Marcus Borg represents a position, an understanding of the resurrection or of biblical interpretation, which takes into account the developments of modernity and critical studies of the scripture. Anytime you have a difference in your understanding of the resurrection or any question, you can be sure that it goes back to a difference in understanding of biblical interpretation. The book that Marcus and Tom Wright wrote together, The Meaning of Jesus' Two Visions, has chapters, each of them contributing a chapter on, for example, the resurrection, the virgin birth, is Jesus God, what difference does it make, and so forth and so on. It's a very interesting dialogue they carry on between them. When I read N.T. Wright, I read my past. When I read Marcus Borg, I read someone who has taken account of the critical studies of Scripture, and the whole drift of the post-Enlightenment world that seeks to understand phenomena apart from the miraculous or the intervention, some supernatural incursion into this world. And so, obviously, for me, I understand, I stand with Marcus Borg, but I respect N.T. Wright as probably as fine a spokesperson as one could have of that traditional point of view. And just to have them speaking together and expressing their differing perspectives brings before us a model of conversation and understanding that I think is very positive. For it is possible to differ with another without writing the other off or living in alienation and separation. We don't do that very well in the religious world. God knows we've not done that very well in the church. Congregations have been split. Denominations have been formed over lesser differences than the differences between N.T. Wright and Marcus Borg on the resurrection. But to hear them, to watch them, to observe them relating to one another, in this case, in the pages of this book, becomes a lesson, a model, I think, for how we can engage one another and respect one another, learn from one another, and continue in relationship, even though we understand that we differ in our perspectives and in our interpretations. As I said, N.T. Wright has a traditional view of the resurrection. If you would read the chapter in the book, The Meaning of Jesus, that he writes on the resurrection, you would find him insisting on some kind of bodily physicality as a sign or as a mark of resurrection. He is a very bright man, and he understands the issues clearly, and he's careful. And so he's careful to indicate that he's not talking about the resuscitation of a corpse, obviously. Nonetheless, he wants to insist on the necessity of the empty tomb. For N.T. Wright, if the tomb is not empty, there is no Easter. There's been no resurrection. Now, Marcus Borg, on the other hand, says the empty tomb is a matter of indifference. He doesn't care if it's empty or not. If the bones, the skeletal remains of Jesus should be found through DNA tracing sometime, Marcus wouldn't care. Because for him, the resurrection is not about a corpse coming to life, but a life in God, a spiritual existence that is still experienced as a presence among those who knew Jesus and followed him. Marcus loves to go to what is also my favorite resurrection story, the Emmaus Road. Two men journeying from Jerusalem on Easter. They're sad of heart because of the events of Good Friday. And they're joined by a stranger. They don't recognize the stranger. As readers, we know that it's Jesus. And he says, "Why are you sad of heart?" And they say, "Well, where have you been?" And then he begins to speak to them about the scriptures, to interpret the scriptural tradition, that what has happened is exactly what would have been expected in the prophetic books, etc. And that's, they come to the village, and it's getting toward evening, and he makes like he would go on, and they say, "Come into us." He comes into their home, he gets in the home, he acts as the host, he blesses the bread and breaks it and gives it to them, and poof, he's gone. But in the breaking of the bread, they recognize him. And they say, "Now that we think of it, did not our hearts burn within us as he spoke to us along the way?" Beautiful story, reminding, of course, of the experience of the Eucharist. Luke is writing this gospel story, what, some 50 years after the events? There's a congregation, there's a community to whom he's writing. It's a community, obviously, that shares the Eucharist. What Luke is saying to them is that the presence of the living Lord is experienced in the community in the breaking of bread. The sacramental nature of the church is the medium by which the risen Christ is experienced in the community. There's no body there. They don't recognize this person. Obviously, this isn't the corpse coming out of the grave. It's a symbolic, a metaphor, a symbol. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. If only Luke wouldn't have given us the next paragraph. Because now they run back to Jerusalem, and they meet with the disciples and a few others on Easter night. They say the Lord was made known to us. And they learn that Peter also had an experience. And now they're gathered there and poof, there he is again. But now N.T. Wright's smiling all over the place, because now this risen one seems to want to underscore a certain physicality. Even though he came poof into the room, nonetheless, he says, "Handle me." And then he says, "Do you have anything to eat?" So now we're dealing with a kind of physicality that is other than that of the Emmaus Road story. Well, Marcus Borg would say, that's a later addition. That indicates a time when faith was being tested, and there was a tendency to speak about a ghost-like existence but lacking reality. And so there was a kind of concreteness that was shadowed forth in this story in order to say, look, this thing is real. This thing, there's substance here. Well, the biblical scholars can talk back and forth. And some of you are in one paragraph and some of you are in another, and that's perfectly all right. That's the way it should be. But as a matter of fact, both Tom and Marcus would say that Easter is the originating event of the church. And that Easter, in its summary, is Jesus lives and Jesus is Lord. That the experience of Jesus post-crucifixion, the experience, whether it was in some kind of story, some kind of appearance, such as Luke records either in Emmaus or in Jerusalem, or whether it's whatever it is, there was a community of people that gathered post-crucifixion that said Jesus lives. And believing that Jesus was alive, that Jesus had not simply died and was done, they said Jesus was right. This was God's vindication of the way of Jesus, of the life of Jesus, of that which Jesus embodied, of that which came to expression in Jesus. And so, what difference does it make whether the tomb is filled with the remains of Jesus or the tomb is empty? If there is a community of people that are united in the fact that what was embodied in Jesus was a way of life and grace. I cited last week that paragraph about how the caterpillar is transformed into the butterfly. The caterpillar carrying with it from the egg certain cells The zoologist calls them imaginal cells. Imaginal, I love it. Those are the cells that have the blueprint of the butterfly. Those cells have the genes for legs and for wings. And that old caterpillar scrounging around on the ground suddenly finds something happening to its physical being that at first is attacked by the caterpillar's immune system as something foreign. But eventually the new takes over and there emerges the butterfly, because that caterpillar was not made to crawl, but to fly. It was not made to be a fuzzy worm, but a multicolored butterfly in the sky. Now, if the transformation takes place, what does it matter? What is the process? If the reality is there, then what's the big deal about the historical details that surround it? For one, a literal story of a body coming out of a tomb. For another, a spiritual transformation. But for both, a transforming presence that is a sign that in this cosmic journey of ours, there is a bias toward life, creativity. If one comes to that conclusion, then one can allow that another may come by it in another way. Why start a new church? Why walk out on the sermon? Why begin a new denomination? Now, I don't mean to say that distinctions aren't important and that differences cannot be significant. Paul, for example, Paul, a Jew who was convinced that the way of Jesus was dangerous, was undercutting the traditions of Israel, and therefore had to be stamped out. He has an experience, a vision. He's blinded. He contemplates. He's turned around 180 degrees. And he becomes the apostle to the Gentiles. Paul, who begins to stamp on the way to stamp out the way, becomes the one who says in his transforming experience, this must be God's move. This must be God's move to include the nations, the Gentiles. Paul never became anything else than a Jew. And Paul never rejected his Jewish religious faith. Paul was a Jew, as Jesus was a Jew, and they understood the God of Israel to be the only God there was. But what Paul saw now was the possibility of all people coming into the relationship in the covenant community of this people of Israel. And Paul began, he said, and you know what? And they don't have to become Jews. The grace of God is sufficient. They can come directly to God without coming by way of Moses and circumcision and dietary laws and all of that. And for Paul, that was a transforming experience. That was a total change of paradigm. It didn't have to be another religion. It was simply the same God of Israel embracing all by grace. Well, But what about the rest of Jesus' Jewish disciples? What about Peter, for example? Well, Peter had an experience too, the house of Cornelius. He has a vision, go preach in Cornelius' house, the Roman legion, centurion. He's preaching, and the Holy Spirit falls on that house, and he says, oh my God, now what? Now they got it too. But Peter was not the man that Paul was, with all due respect to the Roman Catholic Church. Paul saw through. Paul glimpsed grace. Paul saw something new. Peter granted it, but it wasn't the passion of his life. And so they're now out in the mission field, out in Galatia. They're in the community that had started as the result of Paul's preaching. And these are Gentile people now. It's not kosher. The table's not kosher. That's okay with Peter. Peter intellectually knows the truth. Doesn't matter. That's a religious thing. Religious things don't matter. They're optional. You choose them, or they choose you, and you follow them, and that's fine. But they're not absolute. It's not like a lightning bolt's going to hit you. And so Peter has ham and buns in Galatia. But then somebody comes from Mother Church in Jerusalem. Some of James's people. And Peter sidles past the table with the ham and buns. And he moves over to the kosher table. And Paul says, Peter, you're wrong. You're not wrong to stay kosher. Stay kosher if that's your choice. But don't eat one way one day and another way another day because of who's there. Have integrity and authenticity in your person. And so Paul confronts a friend, not about whether he's right or wrong, but about the consistency of behavior. And so I believe in the church as well. It's not as though we need to agree on a lot of things, but the thing we need to be able to do in the community of faith is to talk about it and to move for integrity of understanding and action. So that where our perspectives differ, fine. That's okay. But is there enough that unites us, that is common, that we can celebrate together so that we don't break community? And if it's to be authentic community, then we're also able to confront issues and be honest with one another in order that it may be an authentic community. Because you see, the religious experience, again, well, let me say the human experience is the experience of being rooted in history and therefore marked by limited understanding. And that limited understanding means that there are no absolutes. There may be an absolute, but every human perspective is relative. And every human understanding is a partial and tentative understanding on the way, hopefully, to fuller understanding. And so in the church, as I said with Peter, Peter, you could have stayed Jewish. Israel is ongoing. Israel lives today. There wouldn't have been any problem with Peter continuing in his Jewish faith. But Paul's point to him was, don't equivocate between the two. Don't be hypocritical. be honest in your faith and in your behavior. Friends can differ. And those differences can be argued and can be grounded and founded and legitimate. There's no one to say it is this way and no other way is possible. But when we get an insight, as Paul did, when there's a breakthrough, we ought to be able to bring it to expression and talk about it. For example, Western values in our world, can we talk about them? What about that which looms on the horizon, that possibility of civilizational clash? Are we able to express our values with the most articulate and persuasive way possible without having to kill one another? What about in the church, for example? And the question of sexual orientation. We begin to understand some things. We understand things about the human creature. We understand the diversity of creation. We understand that this is not a matter of choice, but it's a given. Then what is the church to do? To go on with its bias and its prejudice, damning and separating people and cutting them out? Of course not. And if the church does that as an institution, it has to be addressed. The point has to be made so we can be engaged in conversation and dialogue, not to break community, but in order to make community honest and authentic and open. There's no party line here. And I value the diversity of understanding and perspective. Don't expect the pulpit to dot every I and cross every T and be able to embrace them all. I have a point of view and I have a responsibility to make it as clear as I can, and I will. But I promise you as well that I'll listen and we can continue to talk about these things together. And if you'd like a shot at it, come on Wednesday night. We can have a good free-for-all about 6 weeks in a row with differing perspectives authored by two friends who come at it differently. But in the exchange, help all of us, I think, to come to a clear understanding of where we are and why. God knows. The world needs conversation, or we'll kill each other.